What's up, everybody? My name is Lee. Some of you guys might know me as Intuition, and you are tuned in to Kinda Neat. Thank you guys for tuning in, as always. I'm thinking that our guest today is probably going to bring in some new listeners, so if it's your first time listening, thank you guys for tuning in. I appreciate it, and I hope that you stick around. We have a lot of other cool episodes that you guys can check out by going to kindaneat.net and just kind of looking around or subscribing on iTunes. But if you are a loyal listener and this is part of your weekly routine, we have a Patreon going on where you can go pledge $1 an episode, $2 an episode, $3 an episode, whatever you want to pledge per episode to just kind of keep the lights on around here, help us pay rent around the studio, and help put a little extra money into me and Ben's pocket. It would be helpful because we keep it ad-free, and some of you guys are like, oh, you guys should just run ads. Truth be told, it ain't that easy to run ads when you're not on the podcast network and it's just the two of us running this. So patreon.com/kindaneat where you can pledge a dollar amount. So my folks are in town. My mom and dad both came down. They found really cheap tickets from Alaska to come down. I think it was only like $250 or something, which if you've ever flown to Alaska, that's insanely cheap. There were times, particularly when like fuel was really expensive, where tickets could be as much as $1,200 to get from LA to Alaska. So $250 is like insanely cheap. So they came down because my brother is getting married next month. I think I've mentioned that before, but yeah, my brother got engaged and the wedding has been building up, and next month on June 18th, he will be getting married to his lovely fiance, Kendra, who's going to be my new sister-in-law. And so my mom, being the fashionista that she is, she wanted to come down and find wedding clothing for her and my dad. So the day they got in on, it was Tuesday morning, I think, I took them to the Bev Center and I was just like, oh, let's just do it. Let's just knock it out on the first day. So they flew in, picked them up at like 9:45. Oh, actually we went to like, there's a men's warehouse like really close to the airport. So we were able to like get a suit for my dad and got him just a nice gray suit, some brown shoes, going to do a brown belt, got him like a checkered shirt from Uniqlo and a nice, I think it's a Calvin Klein tie or something. Yeah, he looks sharp. He can still look sharp, but he doesn't give a shit about any of that. And then I took my mom to the Bev Center and we kind of did it accidentally a smart way where like while I was looking for a tie for my dad there, we were in the Macy's downstairs and some like dude that's like a man personal shopper was like, oh, if you're looking for a dress, you should go to the Macy's upstairs, the women's department, and like talk to their personal shopper. And we're like, we're kind of skeptical about it, but we ended up doing it. And she just like brought up a couple dresses. And the first one that my mom put on, it was like just this perfect dress that we would have never picked out. So shout out to Jade at Macy's at Bev Center. She's hella fine for one, but also she like picked out an amazing dress. So my mom looks very dapper and sharp. Having said that, spending time with my dad is always kind of interesting because as a lot of you know that listen, my father has Alzheimer's. He's very young. He's only 62 and he has Alzheimer's and it's like really progressing now. And it's pretty crazy because I only get to see him once every like, you know, 6 months or so. So I see him about twice a year. So I'm not seeing it every day. And it's funny because my mom, every time she sees me, she's like, oh, you know, do you think it's progressing? And I'm like, yeah, it's like very obviously progressing. But she, you know, similar to when you look in a mirror every day, you don't realize that you're getting fat until you see a picture of yourself from 2 years ago or something like that. She sees it every day, so she doesn't see a lot of the small progression, but she does kind of keep me informed on like big new stuff. Like one of his new things is like he doesn't really understand the concept of mirrors anymore. And so he'll look in a mirror and be very entertained. And like if he makes a funny face in a mirror, he laughs at it. And I don't know if he's really grasping the fact that it's him in the mirror anymore. Cause one time she said she caught him in the bathroom, just kind of like laughing. She's like, oh, what are you laughing at? And she goes, and he pointed at the mirror and she kind of goes, oh, who's that? And he goes, I know who it is. And she's like, well, who is it? And he said, Steven. And Steven is my younger brother. And so I don't know what that really means. But that's a pretty crazy thought to have. And so, and I saw him doing it while we were while we would be like shopping for a shirt or whatever, he would catch himself in a mirror and kind of like touch the mirror or tap it and kind of laugh or like try to get our attention to look at it as though it was something very entertaining. So that's an interesting thing. And as it's starting to progress, it's really interesting because he's becoming very – it's very like base instinct type of stuff that you notice. Like, you know how you can tell when a little kid is really tired because they start throwing fits or when they're hungry, they start crying and stuff like that. It's interesting being around him right now because I'm starting to notice those kind of base instincts kicking in where like everything will be cool for a while and he'll be real upbeat. Like he still laughs at jokes, I say, and I can see him trying to be fun loving and stuff when everything's cool. But then, on a long day, like on Tuesday, or then I went up to Santa Barbara with them on Friday, on a real long day, like it starts off good, but then by the time it's like food time or by the time it's like the time that he should probably be taking a nap, like his attitude changes crazily. And he like, he'll kind of like borderline throw a fit, not in like a outward way, but like we were up in Santa Barbara and we were waiting for my mom to finish like returning some dresses or something to some store. And her and my grandmother were taking kind of a long time, and he got really impatient, and he was also getting grumpy because it was around a time that we should be eating, and like his blood sugar gets low and he just gets pissed off or something, just like a kid, you know. And at one point we're just sitting outside, it's a beautiful day, nice little breeze, it's nice and sunny out, and we're just chatting, and all of a sudden he looks at me, he goes, "Well, that's it, I'm fucking out of here." And I'm like, what do you mean? He's like, "I'm just done, I'm walking away." And I'm like, walking away from what? He's like, "I'm just done." And I was like, holy shit, like what's happening here? And so I was like, wait, just wait for one second. I'll walk with you. Just wait. And I like ran in the store. I'm like, "Mom, you need to hurry the fuck up because like dad is freaking out and he's about to wander off, you know? So like, you got to hurry." She said, okay. And so, you know, he gets real quiet. And at that point I kind of instinctually understand, okay, like, look, there needs to be no stimulation. Like once we get in the car, everybody needs to be quiet. So like, I'm telling my mom and my grandmother, like, "Hey, in this car ride, I'm just going to get us to the next place. Don't talk. I'm going to turn the radio off, you know?" Cause even, I would put on songs that he knows, you know, cause, if you follow along, you know, like that his, like music does really well with him. He'll hum along and try to sing along to songs and stuff, even though he doesn't remember the lyrics anymore. And so I'll always like put on songs that he knows in the car. And at that point when he got really grumpy because he was hungry, he was like, "All right, turn this off. I've heard it enough fucking times." And I'm like, whoa. It wasn't like I had played it a bunch or anything like that. It was just like, he just wants to like, he doesn't want their stimulation is too much, you know? And at that point, he's gotten to a point where he forgets that he's hungry or forgets that he hasn't eaten or maybe he doesn't like understand that his body is telling him that he's hungry or something. Cause if you ask him like, "Oh, are you hungry?" He'll say, "No, I'm not hungry. And if you go to a restaurant and sit down, you can't like give him a menu and be like, "Oh, what on here looks good to you?" It's kind of like you just pick out something that you know that he'll eat. And it's funny because as soon as the food comes out, he'll just start scarfing it down and the attitude completely changes. Like I said, those base instincts, like as soon as his belly is full and his blood sugar is back to a normal level, like he's cool enough, you know, like it's like he's kind of back to like his normal self again. And then of course you get in the car and he'll like fall asleep. But that's another thing was like, if you say, "Oh man, are you all right? Are you tired?" "No, I'm not tired." You know, it's very much like – it's interesting to watch what it does to the brain because it seems to be very much reverting him back to, you know, a lot of childlike or childish type behaviors, you know, where like – when you're that young, you don't understand what your instincts are telling you, or you don't understand why you're grumpy or why you want to cry or throw a fit. It's not because you're actually sad that your mom won't buy you a toy. It's just because you're really fucking tired, you know? And so I'm watching him now as a 62-year-old man going through that same shit. And all praise is due to my mom. She's a saint for taking care of him and handling all that stuff. And yeah. So anyhow, that's what I went through this week, was kind of looking at that sort of thing and processing it. It's really funny because it's not funny. It's a thing where anytime I tell people about it, they're like, "Oh, I'm sorry." And it's like, man, you don't have anything to apologize for, or like, it's something that I've been grieving, or like the grieving phase is so far gone already, or at least I pretend or think that the grieving phase is over, where I'm like, it's just a part of my reality that like when I'm around my dad, it's not a father-son relationship anymore. It's a patient caregiver relationship. And I oftentimes wonder if I'm like, how am I going to react when he finally passes? Cause I feel like I've been watching him die now for a few years. And, I don't know. That's a dark thought, but it's shit that I think about when they're around. So yeah, it's interesting. But the good news is, found him a suit, went to my tailor. I'm an adult. I have a tailor, you know what I'm saying, that I go to consistently to get things fucking fitted. And, he snipped up the suit all nice, and he's going to look very handsome at the wedding. And, yeah, man. So June 18th, shout out to my brother and Steven and sister-in-law Kendra. They'll be getting married. That was the point of that story. All right. So today's guest, Bobby Hundreds. I'm just a fan of the dude. Like, he's just leads a cool life, does cool shit, has a cool brand, turned his passions into a career, and is one of the just most well, in my opinion, of the people that I follow along with, he's one of the most well-rounded creatives in that he can design, he can write, he's a great photographer, he's just an interesting content creator in general. And so I wanted to kind of figure out where that stuff came from. I mean, I was nervous going into this conversation because I don't know how often the dude gets interviewed. I didn't know if I was going to ask him like basic questions that he was tired of answering, but the conversation went swimmingly, and I think you guys will be entertained the whole time because I was entertained. And without further ado, here is my conversation with Bobby Hundreds. Where are you from? The Valley?
I grew up in Riverside, California.
In Riverside.
So I'm an hour east
of where we are
now. In the IE. In the 80s and the 90s, back before. I mean, it was just straight brown town. I always say it was brown people, mm-hmm. brown air, brown dirt. Like, yeah. It was just a brown town. That's what I grew up around. Yeah.
The IE. Yeah. That's interesting. What was there to do in the 80s and 90s?
There was nothing to do except, get creative. Skateboarding wasn't that big. When I started skating in the early 90s, it had just fallen off of that 80s MTV rise of Tony Hawk Flop Hair.
Right. So it wasn't neon anymore.
Skate was really dead, and kind of what it's like now, really interesting to follow. Super creative, a lot of young brands starting up, run by actual skateboarders. So there's a few of us in the town who skated, and that few also were the same guys that did graffiti, that were the same ones tagging, that were the same ones that were going to the hardcore shows and going to the punk shows. So that's the most that we could do. We got creative in terms of going to venues, supporting local acts, you know, and then there's like a little bit of hip hop going on in terms of like underground.
You were just like
scene.
The quintessential 90s cool kid then.
Yeah.
Like, you were the MTV dream, graffiti,
yeah.
And skating. And
exactly. I mean, maybe, yeah, like now we can say it was cool, but at the time we were so on the fringe. We were just outliers, you know. It wasn't cool at all to skate. It was, if you were skating in the early 90s, it was like, hey, skater dude, isn't that for like blonde surfer boys?
Totally.
And, you know, there's like black kids who skated in my crew that, you know, you never see before.
Yeah. When you say brown town, what was the racial makeup or the ethnic makeup?
Predominantly Latino.
It was all Latinos.
Yeah. It's predominantly Latino.
You're Korean. Yeah.
I'm Korean American. So I grew up around all Latinos and white kids.
Yeah.
You know, there was like 15 Asians in my entire school, high school of 2000 people.
That's it.
So I related to white kids. Like, I just wasn't around my community very much until I went to college in San Diego. It was the first time that I was in an actual Asian American community, and it totally blew my head off. It took me years to acclimate. The same way like a white kid goes to a UC school today and gets blown away that there's like so many Asians, I felt the same way, except as my own people.
No way.
Yeah, I've just always been like, I'm like super whitewashed, like the worst example of a Korean American kid.
Are your parents first gen?
They're first generation. They're the ones who immigrated here.
Okay.
They started off
when did they immigrate?
They immigrated in the late 70s, and that was because the Immigration Act had just passed, right? So before that, for the, you know, hundreds of years before that, America didn't allow Asians, a lot of African countries, Latin American countries. America accepted immigrants from Eastern Europe. Mm-hmm. And so as soon as they opened those floodgates in, you know, the 70s, were just like, the Koreans were just trying to jam over here. And that's, you know, they took the ticket.
And what did your folks do?
My parents, well, my mom is an artist. She never really, you know, made a real living off of it. But my dad was a doctor. But he couldn't find any work, you know, so we started off in Oklahoma. No one would hire him.
In Oklahoma.
Like, no one would hire this guy. Do you remember that? I didn't remember. My brother, my older brother was born in Oklahoma.
Okay, so you have an older brother?
In Sulphur, Oklahoma. Yeah.
How many?
I'm one of three. I'm the middle of three boys.
Okay.
So the first one, my older brother, he's born in Sulphur, Oklahoma. Couldn't find work. No one would hire him. My dad just had these horror stories of people, of managers of hospitals literally screaming racial epithets in his face.
Just,
you know,
like,
you fucking chink. Like,
wow.
You don't even understand what I'm saying to you. Get out of my office. Stuff like that. So
holy
then he
shit.
Moved to Baltimore.
Yeah.
I think he went by himself at first, but he went to Baltimore. That's where I was born.
Question. Have your parents told you sort of like, why did they pick Oklahoma out of everywhere?
I don't know the exact reason, but I've heard plenty of things over the years in terms of, in ethnic studies classes and just from other immigrant stories that when the Asian immigrants started, when the influx of Asian immigrants came into the States at that time, America actually specifically broke up the community so they wouldn't have a stronghold.
Oh,
I don't know if you've ever heard this.
I didn't know that.
And I might be talking out of my ass, but I've heard it from more than a few people and I've read about it and like,
no
who knows
shit.
What's really real.
Just to like avoid like, what to avoid,
any
like
kind of,
what became Koreatown
yeah,
for Christ's
exactly.
sake.
Yeah. Like they didn't know what was going on. They never let in Asians up until that point
right.
in that way. So to open up immigration, they were like, well, look, these people can maybe congregate and take over a community, so let's break them up. So he was in Oklahoma, Baltimore, Virginia,
wow,
you know, all over the South, and then eventually we made our way to Southern California.
Well, when he moved over, did he speak pretty good English?
No, still doesn't.
Oh, really?
He speaks better Spanish than he does English.
No
because,
shit.
You know, most of the women he deals
with. That's
funny.
You know, dumbfounded.
Yeah.
His mom, their immigration story was like, she was ended up in, I think, Argentina is where he was born.
Yeah, that's right.
And she speaks better Spanish than English as
that's
well.
That's funny.
Yeah.
I mean, growing up in Riverside, it's almost as if you're in Argentina or El Salvador.
Well, that's how, they grew up, he grew up in K-Town and it was like everybody was Mexican in the 80s and 90s. You know what I mean? So
that's just what you did.
Yeah, that's so interesting. So your dad speaks better Spanish than English. What about your mom?
My mom just speaks straight up Korean, which was interesting, right? Because I don't speak Korean. My brothers and I, we can understand very rudimentary Korean, but we don't speak it very well.
Oh, you say,
yeah, like, 안녕하세요. I can order something in a Korean restaurant barely.
Right.
But if I travel, like, I probably speak better Cantonese or Japanese than I do Korean.
No
just
shit.
Because I spend more time in those countries.
Now, was that on
else.
Purpose? Were your parents like, look, we don't want you to learn to speak?
No, it wasn't that. It was just we didn't grow up in a community where there were any Koreans.
Right.
You know,
right.
Again, like from the time I was a kid, you know, I dated blonde girls. I hung out with Mexican kids, like, or white kids. Like, I just wasn't around Koreans.
Yeah.
And so I never got to practice it. And
they
spoke to us in real basic Korean as well. So it's interesting growing up in an environment like that where there's just like already a generation gap, a cultural gap, and a language gap that provided the hugest disconnect for my parents and I, to where we never understood what each other was saying. Almost the same to this day. You know, when I see them, it's like I don't even know what we're talking about half the time.
No shit.
Yeah, they don't know what we're talking about, and they don't, and I don't know what they're saying.
Well, and the reason I asked if they were like, if it was like on purpose of like, no, don't speak Korean. Like, I'm third generation Italian, which is not that far removed, but it's like super American in comparison, I suppose. I don't know. But my grandmother doesn't even speak any Italian because her parents were like, we're moving to America. You're not learning Italian.
Oh, wow.
You're going to be fucking American. You know what I mean? So they didn't let her. Like, her eldest brother, she's one of nine. Her eldest brother spoke a little Italian.
Yeah.
But the rest of the kids were not allowed to speak any.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
No, we were allowed to speak it. Yeah. We just spoke it really poorly.
Right.
You know, both my brothers ended up marrying Korean girls, so they're chill in that department. They get to practice whatnot. I married a Japanese American girl. She's fourth generation Japanese American. So sure, great her grandma doesn't speak. Her great grandma doesn't, you know, barely spoke because right. it's like they're basically Americanized.
So you say still to this day with your parents, there's like a little communication issue.
Giant communication.
Well, what does
gap.
That do for the emotional connection then?
I mean, it's tough. It's like, yeah. you know, it was already hard trying to fathom that cultural divide between us. I mean, it's hard for immigrants, right? You're coming to a country, you don't know anybody, you don't know the language or the culture, mm-hmm. and then you're watching your kids grow up in Riverside, California in the 80s and 90s, which was the meth capital of the world, mm-hmm. you know, and carrying a skateboard under his arm when skateboards were a weapon.
Right.
And coming home with spray paint on his fingers and baggy pants and being in gangs and getting in fights and whatnot. I mean, it was hard for my parents. Like, I totally empathize. So, but they emotionally, yeah, that's a huge disconnect. I didn't, my dad didn't hug me until I was 28.
No,
I think
shit.
That was the first time he ever hugged me and said, I love you. And so it's still to this day, it's super weird to like Whoa. Hug, to be hugged by him or, you know, but that's a very typical Korean American story.
Well, yeah, I was going to yeah. say, I worked with a lot of Korean cats when I was doing the Knox City thing. I was the yeah. only white dude. They were all Koreans and all of their upbringings was very much like, they couldn't believe how lackadaisical I was about work, I feel like. And I always thought I was like a pretty hard worker, but like, they're like, dude, you don't understand. Like, our fucking parents is like, if you don't get an A, you're getting your ass whooped type of shit. Like,
oh, yeah.
Was it like that?
Oh, yeah. If it wasn't an A, if it wasn't A plus.
Yeah.
If I had an A or an A minus, I got my ass whooped. And I didn't do that great in school, so I got my ass whooped a lot.
Really?
You know, but when I would bring home a test and say, look, I got an A minus, why isn't it an A plus?
Right,
you know?
Right.
So. And when you're talking about like ass whooping, you're talking like real straight up like 30 style boxing, you know.
No.
This isn't just, yeah, I'm going to use my belt or like yeah. pick a, you know, a kitchen utensil, which like some of my other immigrant friends are, oh, my dad made me like pick out something from the kitchen to hit my bottom with. I'm like, yeah. no, this is like my dad throwing me in the laundry room and like bare knuckle, all right, let's go. And
Damn.
It was just like... straight up Evander Holyfield, you know?
Yeah, that's crazy. And so, I mean, if your dad was a disciplinarian, was your mom any, like, was she a little more empathetic on that kind of stuff?
Yeah,
like,
would she was. She was an artist, but Korean moms
yeah.
are hardcore.
Right.
They're strong, you know? They're like black moms.
Yeah.
They're just like, they run the house. Usually the Korean men are out. Actually, that's not true. Most of the time, if you actually watch the dynamic, Korean women are working just as much and on the same level as Korean men.
Yeah.
I mean, as male dominant as that culture and patriarchal as it could be, I mean, they have a woman president. Mm-hmm. Like, they've always, Korean women have always been running the show over there.
Mm-hmm.
So in the culture, like, my mom ran the house. She was a disciplinarian as much as my dad was. Like, she ran the show.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
There's a lot of drinking in the culture, too.
There's a lot of drinking.
Right?
Which was weird for me, because when I was growing up,
yeah.
I was straight edge. I was straight edge through high school, because I was a part of the hardcore scene.
Yeah.
So just being, when I got to college, and I was around a lot of Korean kids that were just constantly drinking,
right.
and they drink very well, you know, I just couldn't keep up, because I was like, man, like, this is just not me, like,
yeah.
not my culture.
Like, would you see your folks turning up like that?
Of course. That's just a part, when you're growing up as a kid, and just seeing all the dads gather in one room,
yeah.
and the women in the other, and the women are doing their thing, chopping it up, and the dads are just off their face, you know?
Right, right.
Loud, boisterous, and then sometimes violent. Like,
so
Koreans love to fight, Koreans love to drink.
Yeah.
You know, that's what we do.
They found their little, like, group of other immigrants in Riverside to hang out with, or
that's
what
a lot of the Korean-American churches started up that way, if you
okay.
watch across the country. Churches kind of became, as churches often do, a hub for the community,
right?
Build
out across it.
So we grew up in the Korean-American church, and the Korean-American church is different from a typical American church. A Korean-American church stresses a lot the commandment of obey your parents.
Right.
You know, Korean philosophy is based around Confucian ideals of community, and like Western Christian civilization is all about like being individual and like doing your thing and like being like chasing your own dreams.
Right.
And Koreans are all about like, no, you got to take care of your family, your community, and the Koreans first.
Mm-hmm.
So like, that's what you learned about in church. And meanwhile, when you go on break in church, you'd see the dads in the corner cheating each other out of pyramid schemes, and the moms in the corner like picking apart the bean sprout. So it's like, it was an amazing cultural experience, like growing up in that church. That was the only time where I actually had access to seeing Korean Americans and the Korean American way of life. Right. We had to go to a church that was like 45 minutes away from us.
Wow.
Because like we couldn't, you know, there wasn't a decent church in our
town.
You
would head north to LA?
No, we would go to Pomona.
Pomona.
Grew up like going to a church in Pomona.
Did you go to the Glass House a lot growing up then?
At the Glass House a lot, and I still go to the Glass House.
I love the Glass House. One of the best venues.
You know John Halperin,
who
runs it? Well, John, it's still one of the best venues.
Well, so my weird like thing when I first moved to California, the first place I moved to was Pomona.
Yeah.
And I was going to Cal Poly just for 1 year, but I would be at the Glass House probably 3 nights out of the week. Like I wasted so much money at the Glass House. Yeah. And to this day, yeah, it's like the best.
I love it. If a band that I am a huge fan of or longtime fan of, if they're touring and they're playing in LA and the Glass House, I live in LA, yeah. I'd make the drive to the Glass House. And it's sometimes an hour and a half, depending on traffic.
Right.
I do it because the setting is so intimate. There's no industry people there that all got in for free. Well, and it's people who actually enjoy music.
Right, exactly. Yeah. I feel like a lot of the bands I would play at the Glass House, they'll be in LA playing at like House of Blues or something. Mm-hmm. And no shots at House of Blues, even though rest in peace, it's closed down now. It's just not as good of a vibe as the Glass House.
Never.
You know what I mean?
It's all industry. Going to a show in LA is tough, man.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, I'm not a music artist, but I feel for the music artists here. Like, no one wants to dance.
Oh, yeah.
Everyone got in for free because they're on someone's list with someone's homie.
Yeah.
They're all working in the industry. They're jaded.
Right.
You just drive an hour east, go watch a show at the Glass House. You're going to see real fans come out.
I finally got into a point in my life where I kind of won't go to a show unless it's something I want to pay for. And then at that point, it's like, that's buy a ticket than like beg somebody for a list or something. Like, and also even if I'm going to a homie show, I feel like real homies don't ask for lists. They give you that 10 bucks, that 15 bucks. You know what I mean?
If it's 10 bucks, exactly.
So before you found out about skateboarding, I feel like a theme with you that I pick up on just kind of reading your content. Also shout outs, like you're one of the best content creators on the internet. My opinion, you've been doing it a long time. I think you're really great at writing, photography, so very well rounded. But I think that a theme that sticks out in your content is kind of like this obsession with pop culture. So I would imagine, particularly with parents that you're having communication problems with, the TV probably raised you for the first couple of years. No?
It did,
yeah,
it did. And my parents disallowed MTV or any cable in the house.
Yeah.
So when I finally had access to MTV when I moved out, I just drank that in.
Wait, when you moved out?
Yeah.
You didn't have MTV until you moved out on your own?
No, I never even watched it.
I never watched
In Living Color. Anything that was popular in the 80s that was on at night, we couldn't watch that. So the few things that I had, Back to the Future, Karate Kid, like I really embraced those cultural documents. But anything beyond that, I didn't get access to it till I left the house.
No way.
Yeah.
That's interesting. Yeah. I would have totally thought that you like just grew up totally watching cartoons. I thought that maybe like the Back to the Future thing was just like one that stuck out for you. But was
that
had that on VHS?
That was like my template. Whatever was popular that was at the time, what kids were watching in school.
Yeah.
You know, I've never seen an episode of Friends to this day.
You're not missing anything.
I know, man. I'm not missing anything. But Seinfeld too. I didn't watch Seinfeld till I was in my 20s, which to anyone listening now, I'm talking about like in the early 2000s.
And at the time that Seinfeld came out, that was like a real cultural phenomenon. Like that was the one time that my family totally got together and we sat in front of a TV and all watched the same show. You know, Thursday nights, fucking Seinfeld was on, and that was a real momentous occasion.
Yeah.
How do you think it aged when you finally watched it?
Seinfeld?
Yeah.
Well, I'm a huge Larry David fan now because of Curb.
Right.
I kind of did it backwards.
Right.
I went through Curb and then I went back to Seinfeld. I still think it holds up.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
It's interesting to see that really ignited what irony became. And I remember all the hysteria around Seinfeld of that format of entertainment or comedy or sitcom was based around irony, right? Which we grew up in an era of physical comedy, straight up like slapstick comedy.
Borderline racism.
Borderline racism, like traditional family type humor.
Yeah.
And to have that television series enter the picture and basically kick off the ironic movement to what we're still dealing with today.
I think that, almost every popular sitcom since has kind of been based around this idea of like a group of miscreants and sociopaths get together and have misadventures.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And that's exactly what Seinfeld
is. Which never used to happen before that.
Totally.
It used to be very ABC, who was like a family that was dealing with an issue, and they solved the issue.
Right.
And then you learned a lesson at the end of it. There was always like a sit down, a Cosby Show, you know, Cliff Huxtable and Theo, they sit down and he explains to him like, this is where you went wrong. And
this is why you can't shave your head for this music video.
Yes. Yeah, exactly.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And but yeah, there would be no It's Always Sunny. There would be no Workaholics. Yeah. There'd be no Broad City without, that's all the Seinfeld platform essentially.
Yeah, exactly.
So how early was it that you picked up skateboarding then?
I started, as soon as I could probably get on a skateboard, I think I was on one.
Yeah.
But actually being a participant in the culture, I was 12.
Yeah.
So that for me, that was 1992. Again, skateboarding back then, it was dangerous. It was misunderstood. There was no industry really for it. There's one shop in town that was run by a rapist. So your parents didn't want you to go over there. And
wow.
There was like one rack of t-shirts that if it was like an Acme shirt, Blind, a Powell shirt, like that's all you had to represent that you were a skater and you skateboarded, and some giant fucked pants or New Deal pants or some shit.
Right.
And then that's just.
Did you ever have those Volcom pants that used to say like cut here? They had like
no,
a
but I remember those.
You remember those?
Yeah. This was even like pre-Volcom. Like I remember when Volcom started. Volcom was a very subversive brand when it started because it kind of took hold of skate and snow and music culture and put into one. And that was like a very early progenitor of streetwear. I mean, I don't know if they would ever claim that or anyone would say it. They're more or less a skate surf brand today.
Right.
But that's what we loved about Volcom when that kicked off in the mid-90s was that, oh, here's a brand that's not just skate. That's not just snow, not just surf. It kind of embodies everything. You can wear it and you can be like, yeah, I do all those things because we did.
Yeah.
They were very forward-thinking, and I think that was why Volcom had such early success within the community.
Being that you were in the IE, which if you're not from California, like regionally, it's probably what, a good like hour and a half from the beach.
Yeah, an hour and a half from the beach.
Yeah, so,
an hour and a half from LA's beach. It's closer. It's about 40 minutes from Orange County,
like Newport and stuff like that.
Yeah, Huntington. That was our beach.
Was that where your
Huntington?
Okay, so Newport, would you guys make like soirees out to the beach? Somebody's parents take you out there?
No, because we didn't. When you grow up in Riverside, especially back then, this is pre-internet.
Yeah.
You just kind of think the whole world is Riverside, right? Depending on where you grow up, you think that that's what the rest of the world looks like. So
that's the interesting thing that I'm getting at is I feel like people that grow up in those kind of communities that are kind of isolated, you hear about these kids like in Torrance or Compton or wherever that have never been to the beach before, even though they're like 20 minutes from it, 15 minutes from it.
I barely went to the beach growing up, and it was just 40 minutes away. I mean, we live in Southern California.
Yeah.
People travel from around the world to get to where we were to go to the beach, and we just never went to the beach.
Right.
It just wasn't a part of the culture, especially being like, again, a minority kid and hanging out with other minority kids. A lot of these, you know, didn't have money, and so it's like the idea of going to the beach was just like, that's kind of just like what cheerleaders and jocks do,
which is so funny because like when you break it all down to brass tacks, it's like that's where skate culture comes from. It was bred and born from surf culture,
totally.
And you'd figure like, oh, I want to go like surf,
but it was the opposite for us. It was like, we have no connection to surf culture. I surf this morning, I don't really skate anymore. I'm more of a surfer, but I still don't relate at all to surf culture. Surf culture doesn't speak to me. The industry doesn't speak to me. I really can't connect with most surf brands.
Yeah.
There's some that get it, you know, but that support the arts or whatever. But when I look at surf culture, I don't see me. It doesn't represent me or embody anything that I stand for or I live.
Yeah.
So I've never, like, it's interesting. A lot of surfers in LA, especially, they feel this way, the same way that I do, where we just don't connect or relate to that world at all.
I feel like the American surf culture, brand wise, kind of rotates around San Diego.
Sure, yeah. San Diego and Huntington.
But the whole San Diego vibe, people wouldn't realize that aren't from California, but the whole San Diego vibe is so different from LA. Like, they're different fucking planets.
Oh,
man.
Yeah.
Like,
I went to school there. I lived there for 4 years.
How did you like it?
It was cool going to school there. I mean, it was so mellow and chill. I think for me, it was a nice kind of break between a transition between Riverside and eventually where I ended up in LA. But to go to San Diego, I mean, it's a great place to retire, but it's white.
It's so white.
It's so white.
And as a white dude, people get so confused that I complain about how white San Diego is.
But I get
very uncomfortable when I'm in a room full of only white people. I grew up in Alaska, and believe it or not, Alaska's super diverse.
I never
grew up in a room or a classroom that was full of white people. And in Los Angeles, you're never in a room full of white people. I was in Iowa 2 weeks ago, and we were in a fucking a barbecue restaurant that had a floor of about 100 people. Everyone was white,
yeah.
And it was crazy. And that's how I feel sometimes in San Diego. I'm like, where are all the POCs?
Is I'm the opposite. Yeah. Is that I feel comfortable in the Midwest with a bunch of white people.
Really?
Just because of how I grew up.
Yeah.
Like, I just, you know, my friends lived in trailers.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, so I just...
Oh, I grew up around trailer people too. Don't get me wrong.
I don't know why. I've just always related better with white culture. And I'm fascinated with... pure white Midwestern American culture the same way they are probably fascinated with the exotic Orient.
Right.
You know, the way that Americans have this fascination with, like, Japan and anime and manga and otaku culture and, like, China and, like, oh, it's so weird, all your crazy cute little foods. I want to go visit there.
Yeah.
That's how I feel
and, like,
whenever I have an opportunity to fly to the Midwest for anything, I'm down.
Yeah.
Like, oh, we in the fall, we went to Cleveland, you know, Chicago. I was like, I want to go to Cleveland. And last week, we were in Philadelphia. I love it.
That's where my family's from.
Okay.
Yeah.
I love it. And it's racist as hell.
Oh, yeah,
like,
yeah.
Some of the neighborhoods we were in, we went to Gino's Cheesesteaks, and they have a sign on the window that says, if you, you know, this is America, speak English when you order.
Wow.
Yeah.
Oh, I'll never forget when I think I've told this story when my mom was on the podcast, but one of the first times I really, like racism really smacked me in the face was, like, I was 7. I went back to Pennsylvania for my grandfather's funeral, and my Aunt Lou, like, that's my mom's godmother. We roll up to her house, and my mom's like, how is everything? How are you? And she's like this little old Italian lady, and she goes, well, you know, everything's fine, but all the N-words are starting to move into the neighborhood. And I was like, I being 7, I remember, like, thinking, like, okay, I can't speak out about this now, but as soon as Aunt Lou turned her back, I pulled on my mom. I was like, Mom, she said the N-word. I couldn't believe it. But anyway,
that happens in LA just as much.
It does.
As
oh, I'm sure. So absolutely.
I hear it all the time where I'm like, really?
Right. Was your older brother into cool shit?
Yeah. So this is interesting. My older brother. And my brothers and I, we weren't that close. We didn't really have a super tight family growing up.
How much older is he than you?
He is 3 years older. And I have a younger brother who's 4 years younger.
Yeah.
We're all really different from each other. And in a lot of ways, we're the same. But he grew up, he's basically black.
Yeah.
Okay? Like, he was totally immersed in black culture. All his friends were black. He was a huge hip-hop guy. Like, beyond hip hop, reggae, you know, like weird, like deep R&B, like just in, you know, in the '90s, he was that guy.
Yeah.
He was like wearing like a tough gong hat, you know, like he was that dude.
Did he like grow dreads? Was he problematic
if my parents would have allowed it, he would have, but he wore basketball jerseys every day. Wu-Tang Clan concert tees, which would be so valuable today in hindsight. His walls were just plastered with, you know, pullouts from Source. And I always stole his Source just for the graffiti page in the back.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
He like was like taking out the pictures of like Onyx and like putting them on his wall and like, you know, lots of basketball
stuff. It's so interesting. Well, it's funny. One of my guests a long time ago, actually, he was my guest last week too, this dude, Johnny Polygon. He made this joke the first time we ever did a podcast about Asian folks and was like, you know, early on, Asian folks in America, they have to get in where they fit in. And
sure,
some of them choose to be like Caucasian, and some of them choose to be Afro-Asian.
Yep.
I would say in L.A. even, you see a lot of dudes that grew up with a heavy Mexican influence,
heavy Mexican,
and you get
influence.
Like Cholo Asian
dudes.
That's
like dudes. Roy Choi. Yeah.
I always say that, like, whenever I'm trying to describe what Kogi is, I'm like, you know, Roy Choi, he's like super Mexican influenced. You can see it in his tattoos and everything.
Yeah.
And so that's why his restaurant makes sense.
It's totally true that we didn't have, and to this day, we still don't have a large enough in platform or strong enough voice as an Asian American community for young Asian Americans to be like, I want to be like that dude. It's finally happening with our generation, with guys like Dumbfounded and Roy Choi. There's finally, I love it. It's one of the greatest joys of the modern age and with the internet is watching Asian American icons or leaders emerge from the community that young Asian Americans can look up to. Even with me, you know, I get it from time to time, and it's wonderful. It's young Asian American kids being like, man.
I mean, dude, you're tripping if you don't think you're one of those guys to say, even with me, like, you're one of those guys. Like,
I hope so.
Yeah, absolutely.
I hope so. I always wanted that when I was growing up. Look, we had, in skateboarding, I had two guys. You know, I had, like, Gideon Choi and Daewon Song.
Yeah.
You know, Shiloh Greathouse, I think, is half. You know, and then there was, on the music side, there was a James Ihan Smashing Pumpkins.
Right.
And, that's it, maybe. Like, there was Jin? A guy on...
Does Jin even
Jin
count?
Jin didn't even come around until I was, like, in college.
Right, right.
And that was, like, the biggest deal for us. It was, like, Jin the MC.
Right.
You know? So,
yeah,
like,
I'm trying to think of, like, any Asian musicians. I can't even think of any when we were kids.
The Fushnikins, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so we had Fushnikins. We had, in the underground scene, you had, like, Mountain Brothers.
Oh, Mountain Brothers. That's
Mountain Brothers. Yeah, yeah, you know, you had these guys that were, like, super early on. There used to be guys.
DJ culture was super Asian-centric.
In Filipino, Northern California, Scratch Pickles, like, Hubert, those types of dudes.
Right.
But just
not a lot.
Just not a lot. And, like, it was just... And still to this day, not enough.
Right.
You know, for how, just population per capita wise, Asians are 60% of the planet.
Right.
And like, where are we in American pop culture? The rest of the world has got it. Chinese, Hong Kong movies, Korean films, Korean pop music. Like, everyone's watching them now.
Right.
And America's now kind of behind. But like, when we were growing up, my brother had to emulate black culture. He's like, okay, this is where I fit in because I like black basketball. So, like, I guess I hang out with the black dudes. And for me, I was never good at sports. I just didn't care. I gravitated towards skateboarding. Oh, I guess I'm a white kid.
So did you guys beef over that kind of stuff?
All the time.
Yeah. Because you guys are that perfect age to be very competitive with each other.
Very competitive. Yeah. And he was all about just mainstream, a lot of heavy, you know, rap. Just Bobby Brown type rap all the way to woo and foo rap.
Right.
And I was like, nah, punk rock and alternative and metal, you know, like that was my thing. And it was, again, in the 80s and 90s, if you did one, you didn't really do the other.
Right.
You know, and it wasn't until we were in high school that I started opening up to rap in a way that I really appreciated from the underground, right?
You know, that's funny. Well, for all intents and purposes, we're about the same age. And it was very similar to me where growing up, it seemed like you had to be into one or the other. And my early influences were super rap centric. And then my school was like so rap heavy. But I had this like rebellious streak to me where I went, all right, you know what? Everybody at my school listens to rap. I'm going to get into punk rock. Yeah. And then it was like, boom, I had to like stop listening to rap and be the punk rock kid for a couple years. And then by the time I got back to college, I was like, wait, rap is like, that's it's like so great. I don't know why
it's
I'm ignoring
so great.
It. And I realized like, oh, you can like live together
it's
with
all the
stuff.
Same thing. It all came from black music.
Right.
It's all the same, you know, and it just took different paths. But if you pay attention to what's going on culturally, but you know, I don't know what it was with the 90s and cliques, but everyone just kind of had to choose their thing.
Right.
And that's why skateboarding was so great at the time, because skateboarding was the thing, was the movement or the culture that cracked it open for young people, because you'd watch a skate video and one guy would have a
punk
casual
rock,
song playing and then next was like the Beatles playing.
Yep.
And you could listen to that whole soundtrack. You're watching a soundtrack, right? And you got so many different kinds of music that you're like, oh, I guess it's cool because I'm a skater. Like, I can listen to rap and I can listen to metal.
Right.
And that was so very early in that type of thinking to where now, like, everyone, it's like a salad bar, you know? Everyone's just like, I just take what I want. But at the time, you really did have to choose. Like, you're like, oh, you're into this?
And it was like pre-internet kind of, too. Mm-hmm. So, like, skate videos were a way that a lot of people found out about music.
Yep.
You know?
That was like a pre-internet type of thing.
Right.
That was like the Grateful Dead tapes or something.
Totally.
It's like that's how you traded information culture.
Who were the kids, when you start taking skateboarding kind of seriously, did you like instantly find your clique? Were there the other kids that were drawn to it?
Yeah, because there's only five of us in the entire school.
Right, okay. So how did you guys find each other?
we really were like, you skateboard, I skateboard. I mean, it was kind of like, look, it was a little bit more dangerous back then, so it was just the bad kids.
Yeah.
You know, the kids who didn't dress right, who smoked weed in the bathroom during class and just were kind of the misfits. And I was an angry kid. I'm still an angry person.
Why?
I think a lot of it had to do with, number one, being a middle child.
Yeah, for sure.
Being unloved or seemingly unloved. And my dad and I just went at it. You know, my dad and I had just a terrible relationship growing up. So that kind of manifests itself into me just being, I don't know what came first, chicken or the egg. Like, he was always like, you were just like a problem child.
Yeah.
But I was like, well, I was angry.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know? Like, I didn't get the love I think I needed.
But isn't that interesting how those things that, I mean, I guess a psychotherapist would call them like the emotional flaws or whatever, the emotional disabilities. Sure. Those are also like the fucking perfect storm to become a successful businessman.
Totally. You know, look, I don't regret any of it now. You know, like, I don't have any, I don't look back on it with any ill light, you know. It's just, it was what it was, and it made me who I am. And when I see a lot of happy people that grew up in wonderful homes, they're amazing, but just like not the most interesting stories, you know.
Totally.
And creativity, it comes of struggle.
It does. It comes from dark places.
It comes from struggle and dark places and hardships and feeling misunderstood. I constantly feel misunderstood. I'll be like that till I die. And it's exhausting. It's an exhausting way to live, to be like perpetually looking for a better way to explain yourself or to be heard or for someone to accept my way of thinking.
Has that competitiveness carried over too from, like, skateboarding? I think is very self-competitive.
It's self-competitive.
But then that competition with your older brother maybe, or like do you? I was going to say, I find like the content that you put forth and the attitude that you put forth to be very kind of positive outlook, happy-go-lucky. But hearing the story underneath, I wonder, like, does competition drive you as well?
It does, but it really comes from that skateboarding spirit. If I'm really competing against myself, and I acknowledge that even back when I would be compared to my older brother, because my older brother, he missed like 2 on his SATs. I missed 4, and I was held to that standard.
Really?
I had like a 1490 on my SATs, and my parents were like, yeah, but your brother.
And you were the bad student,
1550 or 1570 or something.
Holy,
you know?
Shit.
And they were just like, you're a lost cause.
Wow.
You know, like, I got into great schools. Like, I was like, for kind of failing someone, like, I got a C in PE. Like, I don't know how you get a C in PE. Like, I failed classes. Somehow I got accepted to Berkeley, all the UCs, and they were just like, it doesn't matter. Like, your lost cause. It's like, and not until, you know, now it's been a few years now, but it was not until pretty recently that my parents were like, you know what? You were the one, actually. Yeah. We should have been watching you.
Right.
Like, you figured it out. And I'm like, well, maybe that's why I figured it out, is because I kind of had to fend for myself.
Right.
You know, like,
that's,
I had to figure this out on my own.
Yeah.
And, you know, again, like, creativity being born of struggle. The environment I grew up in, we didn't have the nice skate parks, and we didn't have all the best skate equipment. So we kind of had to make do with whatever board we had. We duct tape our shoes. We made ramps out of drainage ditches. Like, that's creativity that I carry on to this day. I'm resourceful. I can look around this room and figure out a way to make, you know, I don't know, like an amusement park out of it.
Well,
if I wanted
to. I think
to.
Like, that is the one thing about successful people that I have met is that word right there, resourceful.
Mm-hmm.
It's like you get a fucking wrench thrown in your plan and you figure out how to use the wrench for your benefit.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. As soon as I started to see no difference between success and failure and just realize they're relative and that there is nothing. It's just like another step in my story, right? Like, I'm just telling a story. I'm writing a story, and at the end of my life, I'll have a great story. But like, I don't know what I'm doing most of the time, especially with my brand and business. My partner, Ben, and I, we never went to school for this. We had no connections. No one trained us in this. And especially in streetwear, at the time that we started, there was no one really to emulate. There was no blueprint to how to do this. So to this day, every single moment of the day, we're just kind of doing everything by the seat of our pants. We're like, well, maybe this will work. Sometimes it works. If it doesn't work, I'm like, that's not really a failure. That's just, I learned something from that.
Through that detour,
I learned this, and I met this person, and then I just, you know, I'm just back on another path.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I guess I kind of have to keep it optimistic. It's just, maybe it's a lot of self-deception, but it's the only way that I know how to get through.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, you get beat up in this industry.
Absolutely.
Like, fashion is impossible.
Yeah.
You know, it's so trend-based. It's so many things that are out of your control as a business person.
Yeah.
That you have to start looking at it more objectively after a while and just take a lot of the emotional aspect out of it and be like, you know what, man, I'm having fun.
Totally. Know? Well, the fact that you have to remind yourself, that makes me, wonder, like, do you deal with depression stuff?
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I get hit hard.
I kind of figured that after starting to hear the story, I go through depression stuff too. I feel like a lot of people do.
Yeah.
How do you, as a creative whose livelihood depends on being motivated and staying creative, like, how do you fight through that to get off the couch and do something?
I think it's a lot of that Korean work ethic that's innate. That's just something that my parents drilled into me, and I never appreciated it when I was a kid, but it was just like, you're not feeling well, you're going to school.
Right.
You know, like, you want to go out and skate, like, you got to finish this first.
So you just force yourself.
Just force yourself.
Take the reps.
And that's just constantly resonating in my head of get up and go out and do this. Bar none, I'm an introvert. I'm very introverted, which most people would never expect in the position that I'm in. Oh, you have a lot of social media followers. Yeah, social media is amazing for an introvert.
Because
I'm just in my head.
Exactly. You know? Exactly.
Like, I'm not like out at a party. You never see me out at parties. I've lost so many friends and gotten in so many beefs with brands because I didn't go to their party. It's hard for me. It takes a lot. There are some days where I'm like, I just want to stay home. I just want to stay home and work from home. And I will call it in. You know, I'll tell Ben, like, yo, I got to work from home today. I just can't deal with people. But it's just about realizing that I have a responsibility, not to myself, to my immediate family, to the people I work with every day who are looking to me for guidance and for leadership, for my general community of the hundreds. Kids look up to me and say, like, look, man, like, I love your brand. Like, I want to do what you did. I have a duty and a responsibility for how they've supported me, for me to show them how to do it as well. And, like, that requires me getting out of bed and participating in the world.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, I love, you know, being an I think introverts run the world. And I think the last 100 years were run by extroverts, for different reasons, one or another, industrial revolution, whatever it was, people were migrating and the extroverts stuck out. But we're now in an age where the introverts are really being valued again.
Right.
And we're the ones that are actually doing the work.
Right.
You know,
right.
So I'm looking forward to this next age where we can really champion introversion. But at the same time, it's really important to also participate in your community and in the world and contribute. This is why we're here. I just don't believe in an existence. Like, as much as I dream of one day I want to disappear in the mountains somewhere and never talk to anyone again, like, that's really my dream. I'm like, one day I'm going to disappear. Like, people are going to be, where did that guy go? And I'll just be in bliss in a jungle or on a mountaintop and writing a book that no one will read but myself. Like, that's how I want to end it.
Right.
But for now, I'm here on this earth to participate with other people. I think this is why we have other people.
Yeah.
You meet other people, you inspire them, you teach them. They're teaching you, and everyone's teaching each other. We're all leaders here.
Do you ever feel that weight on your shoulders of being a prisoner to the thing that you've created?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, all the time.
Yeah.
I was right before I got here, I was at my friend Sophia's house, and she runs Nasty Gal, and she's been running Nasty Gal for 10 years, and she shares a lot of that sentiment as well, because there gets to be a point where, all right, I proved my point.
Right.
You know,
like when can I have a day off?
Yeah, like I did this, you know, exactly. When we started this brand, Ben and I always used to tell ourselves, well, we work hard now, we never sleep. We work hard now so we don't have to work hard later.
Right.
I work much more today than I did when I was 23. I work twice as much for half the money.
It's this idea of like sacrifice current self for future self, but today's current self is yesterday's future self. You know, it's like, when does this quote unquote future self, like,
it never materializes.
Yeah, exactly.
I've come to accept it. And I realized that, okay, fine. I'm a prisoner to this thing I created. I'm going to embrace it. And I'm going to set up this jail cell with all the amenities that I enjoy. And I'll start self-deceiving myself. But really, what people don't realize when you're starting something, when a young person is starting something, you're like, yeah, I want to do this for the rest of my life. Okay, just know that you are creating like a life sentence there.
Right.
Not even if you don't do that thing for the rest of your life. For the rest of your life, if it takes off at some point, people are always going to hold you to it.
That's
I will always be attached to that cartoon Atom Bomb, which is our mascot. We don't even really run that thing anymore. We haven't really pushed it for years, and people still every day, oh, you're the guy who does the hundreds? You do that bomb.
Do you want to know the funniest thing?
Hmm.
On the ride over here, driving down Alvarado, I'm behind a Toyota truck. He's got two stickers on the back of his car. One of them, Jordan Brand. The other, the Atom Bomb.
Oh, amazing.
And I said, oh, that's a good sign. I'm seeing the fucking Atom Bomb on the way here. This is going to be a great talk.
There was a moment where, there were years where I despised, I mean, it was always a joke within the company that was my greatest enemy.
And
no matter how much I try to kill him, I realize that I work for him. And my kids always, when they see Atom Bomb, they're like, Atom Bomb. If you ask them, what's Atom Bomb? They say, Daddy works for him. Because I do.
That became your Mickey Mouse of sorts.
That's my Mickey Mouse. Yeah. I'm beholden to him. And I hated it for so long because I was like, take me seriously. I'm an artist.
Right.
Take me seriously. I'm
like,
a
this
writer.
This is not going to be my greatest creation.
I'm a photographer. This is, I can't be known for just this hit.
Right.
And I've been making a documentary for the last 2 years, and I sat down with John Mayer at one point, and John Mayer said to me, he's like, you think I like playing Your Body is a Wonderland every
night?
He's like, you think I don't know that maybe the best years of my work are behind me? He's like, how does that feel?
Right.
Which is a frightening thought to a creative person. Well, when you're young and you're starting something, you don't think like that, but
that's
you
good,
will create something.
Well, that's
that
a great
will
conundrum that
you
brought up. Do you feel as a creative those footsteps of like, I'm not as creative as I used to be, or I'm not as concerned as I used to be. Sometimes as an artist, I feel like I don't have as much to prove as I used to feel like I have to prove. Now that I'm comfortable in my own skin, I'm not as competitive with myself as I once was. You know what I mean? And I particularly in music, I don't know how it is with design or that world, but I mean, most people in music, they do their best work between 18 and 25
or something,
you know, 27. And so once you get up into your 30s and your 40s, it's like, you know,
you're comfortable.
Yeah,
you have family.
Nobody wants Neil Young to play his newest records.
No.
They want to fucking hear Helpless. They want to hear, you know,
because you're starving and you're desperate.
Yeah.
And I think there's something romantic about that.
Yeah,
and yeah, for sure. That side of my creative life is over.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I can eat good food now.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have a huge house, but I have a nice house with a nice car. I used to drive a RAV4 for like 10 years that everyone used to make fun of me for my bumper
fell
off.
That's what my dad used to drive. Shout out RAV4.
I love the RAV4.
Yeah.
I kind of wish I still had a RAV4. I'm trying to get back to a pickup truck. That's another end goal of mine.
Yeah.
That part of my creative life and career is done. When kids, or when not kids, but people my age, like, oh, I miss that early stuff where you were like this and doing that and taking photos. I'm like, yeah, that was rad back when I was 25 on Fairfax and, you know, there was no one on the street and we skated every day and partied and took photos and I was out at CineSpace every night and, you know, doing things. Yeah, that was amazing. But I also had bleached hair at that time. I don't think it's wise for me to bring that back either. Like, there's just a time and a place for that. And the creative moment I'm in now, I love. It's a different type of creativity. It's creativity in terms of how I orchestrate the business, in terms of how I'm branding myself as an individual. It's in terms of just being a good manager. Like, that takes a creativity too. It's
absolutely
less outward facing, public, social media visible stuff, but it's more just life happiness, you know,
right.
life fulfillment, where I get to see people that I'm directly interacting, engaging with every day and leading and going like, look, I'm building a good team. We're making stuff we're proud of and we have a strong company. Like, I love that.
Right. And I would say a lot of times perhaps non-creatives don't kind of realize that a good idea is a good idea and it feeds into that same part of your brain. So like when I see you redesigning the 100 site to kind of something that I've not seen before, like something kind of new. It's almost like not chronological.
Yeah.
It's kind of chaotic, but at the same time, kind of organized. And you have all these people coming together, curating in their own way. And then you're kind of the head curator of all of that.
Sure.
I'm sure that taps into the same part as when you designed that Atom Bomb, said, oh, this
totally
is going to be something.
It's all just creative solutions to problems. There's always a problem to fix. So yeah, to your point, when you're like, do you ever feel like you're running dry creatively?
Right.
Yeah, of course, on an artistic front, some days I'm just like, yeah, I'm just not feeling it.
Right.
Or like photographically. Lately, to be honest, I've been kind of in a dry spell with my photography for like the last half year.
Yeah.
Where I barely even carry my camera around anymore just because I'm like, I feel like I've shot everything and nothing's really pushing me. But that creative ingenue has moved over to different facets of my life and career, and you know, it's in the way I cook my eggs in the morning.
Right.
You know, I have like 8 different ways of cooking eggs,
oh,
and it's
shit.
Just different, and it's not the typical success that you would see that would was born of that creativity.
It's not the shit that people can immediately put their finger on. No. But for you, it's still feeding that same part of your soul.
Yeah. I'm forever just a creative person trying to figure out problems. Right. Like something doesn't work.
I try to explain that to people. You know? People are like, oh, why don't you make music anymore? And I'm like, well, I mean, like, it's not, it doesn't speak to me the way it was at one point in my life. But yeah, the same thing. Like learning how to make a perfect omelet is fucking speaking to me.
Exactly.
Learning how to make my fucking potatoes perfect in under 7 minutes, that speaks to me. You know what I mean? Right now. And it's the same kind of thing.
That digital content game for me was what it was the last 2 to 3 years. And it still is.
Yeah.
Content creation.
Yeah.
Working with the team editorial platform, writing great articles, great stories.
Yeah.
Videos, a lot of video work, film work. I've been, again, working on that documentary, but that whole process is a whole new world to me that I love. It's just like brand new, you know, like from the pre-production to the post-production to what types of cameras to use to cuts and directing. You know, I just got done directing a commercial for our brand that took me a course of 3 days. Alexa camera was just like beautiful. It's a beautiful piece. And, you know, I don't care to ever be known as a famous director, but it's just for me another creative outlet. Like, I just had to do it.
Right.
I'm.
Do you get obsessed with new projects like that?
Obsessed. Yeah. Obsessed. Like, I'm like most creative people where I look at something and I can't really enjoy it. I'm trying to figure out how they did it. You know, like, I'm staring at all the comics on your wall and I'm like, a normal person, you know, probably lesser creative person, but someone who can just appreciate as a fan is like, oh,
that's a cool idea.
I'm like, how? I want to do that.
Right.
How do I do that? I want to have a comic. And it's like ego.
Yeah.
And it's just like me being like, nah, I got to be the best at everything.
Yeah.
But I can't, that's why I can't watch TV. You know, like I watch TV and I'm like, I don't want to watch TV. I want to make TV.
Right.
You know, like the whole entire time I'm watching an Oscar film, I'm like just taking notes in my head. I can't even enjoy the story because I'm like, oh, I like how they use the lighting there and this camera. And like, I love that pause and that beat was amazing. And, you know, and then I'm like, when I make my movie, I'm going to do this. Like this, I'm just taking notes. So, you know, I get obsessed, you know, and that for the last few years, it was about content creation. And just over the last 8 months or so, I fell really back in love with designing apparel and doing graphics for t-shirts.
Dope.
Great. In a time when no one wears t-shirt graphics anymore. And that's why I think I love it.
Yeah, as we're both sitting here in blank tees.
Yeah. No one buys graphic tees anymore. So I think it's a challenge. I'm like, you know what? I'm going to figure it out. I'm going to make people buy graphic t-shirts again.
Right. It was like 2 or 3 years ago, people were going over the top, extreme with the graphics, like all over every inch of the shirt.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then I think
– and now it's just like everybody's back to simplicity.
People want to just kind of be discreet, you know? Which I totally understand and I can't fault them for. And I like
what'd you major in when you – did you go to UCSD or did you go to
UCSD?
Okay. What'd you major in?
I majored in – at one point I was – triple majoring.
Huh.
So I went in as a communication media major, which anyone who doesn't know what they want to do does. And then I was like, what am I doing? Like, I was in the class with a bunch of sorority girls, which was awesome. But I was like, I don't know what I'm going to do here.
You're very exotic to them.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. They're like, oh, like, you're not like the other Asian guys. I'm like, that's right.
Asians with swag.
Yeah. and then I was like, maybe I like how people think, so I'll do psychology. So I started going down to psychology. So I eventually picked up a minor in psychology, computing and the arts, which was basically early web design.
Okay.
It was like HTML.
Yeah.
I was like, well, I'm an artistic guy. Maybe there's a career for me in that path of computing. It's more in the design graphics. It wasn't graphic design. It was like web design and theater. It was theater, which was
theater.
Like, yeah, my theater was like my main thing that I loved.
That was your thing.
Mm-hmm.
So were you going to be an actor?
I wanted to be an actor.
Really?
Yeah.
Like a young B.D. Wong or what?
Yeah. I just, again, I grew up in an environment or in a world where there were no Asian American actors. And
he
was
like the only one. That's why it popped into my head.
Yeah, B.D. Wong. B.D. Wong.
Yeah.
Sulu, right?
Oh, right.
And the guy who in 16 Candles, Getty Watanabe,
who
ruined it for us
Long
and took
Duck
us
Dong.
Back like 5,000 years.
Right, totally.
So, you know, growing up where I was a fan, again, of pop culture and film and not seeing me anywhere, and still to this day not really seeing me anywhere.
Right.
I was like, I want to change that. You know, like, again, typical Bobby thinking of like, I'm going to make it a point to show that you can have an Asian American male in the lead and it'll work. And I lost that battle because the more I tried to get into that industry after I graduated, I was like, there's no place for Asian American
men. So that was your initial – was that your initial move to L.A.?
That was my initial move to L.A.
To act.
That's what I was here for.
Did you get like an agent and all that and you're going to auditions?
But, yeah. I had an early – I don't know if he's agent, but I had like a manager or something like that.
Yeah.
But it didn't last very long and I was not making any money. So in the meantime, I just started freelance writing.
Yeah.
I was freelance writing for a bunch of magazines.
How did you know that you were – I mean – I have so many writers that are talented writers. They didn't like, they're not trained. You're not like formally trained at writing, but your writing is great.
Thanks.
Yeah, you're welcome.
I never considered myself a good writer.
I don't consider myself a good writer either, but people tell me, oh, I love
reading. You're a good writer,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, but it's accidental.
It was only after hearing that so much that only maybe really 4 or 5 years ago, I was just like, oh, I guess I'm good at writing. I should do it. But when I look back at my life, when I was, I have notebooks when I was like 8 years old, 10 years old, 12 years old, where I was writing short stories.
Right.
You know, like I would, which is weird to me because I have a 7-year-old boy now, but to think that I was just in my room on like an Apple IIe writing science fiction stories and like superhero comics and like writing like huge, like it took me like 6 months to write these little books.
Wow.
You know? And, yeah. And so I guess I was always a writer. My parents didn't encourage my art. They actually discouraged my art.
They're like, you're wasting your time. Do your math homework.
Yeah. Again, yeah. Typical immigrant thinking. But they're like, we didn't move all the way here from Korea and go through everything so that you can be a starving artist.
Right. But isn't it kind of interesting? I'm sure that you've noticed this over the years where like things that you're truly passionate about – you don't need to go to school for them because you get so obsessed with them that you want to teach yourself.
That's so true.
And oftentimes the people that really have a love for something and train themselves, they do so much better in that field than people that have to go somewhere and be told how to do it, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
That's basically summing up my writing career.
I mean, that's kind of, it sounds like it's summing up your design career and a lot of stuff.
It sums up everything.
Right?
I never took an art class. I never took a writing class.
Photography class.
Never took a photography class.
And like, I went to photo school. Like I have a BA in commercial photography and I look at your photos and I go, oh, that guy's a legit photographer.
Thanks.
Yeah.
I started shooting film when I was 12.
Yeah.
And found my dad's old camera in the closet and we would go out and skate and I would shoot my friend skating. If you want to learn how to shoot fast and well, you shoot skateboarding and shoot live concerts because they're impossible.
I grew up shooting snowboarding because
snowboarding, same thing.
I got to a point in my life where like I'm being from Alaska, snowboarding is kind of what skateboarding would be in California because you can do it more of the year. And I got to a point where my friends were getting really good, and I was like,
yep.
I wanted to be a pro snowboarder, but I was like, I'm clearly not as good as these guys, so I want to start shooting them.
that was me, so
that I can still travel with them, and like be on the road, kind of living the life of a pro.
I was just always so much more of a nerd about the snow and skate culture, you know, and even music culture, because I grew up playing the violin, but my parents wouldn't let me play the guitar or drum, so that's why I immersed myself in punk culture, because that's like what I wanted to do,
right?
You know, but I couldn't do it.
Did you stay how long did you stay straight edge?
I stayed straight edge from 16 to pretty much through college. So
was it all 21, three? Was it all three X's?
It was straight up three X's. Like I was straight up like militant vegan.
Yeah.
No drugs. No drinking.
But
pretty much no sex.
Yeah, I was gonna say, is that what about sex? I always ask straight edge because I'm like, what about that third sex?
Yeah,
what about sex?
That's the part that Ian McKay, you know, like he kind of let go after a while. He's like, all right, that's not really what it's about.
Right.
That's, you're asking for the end of the world if your teenagers can't have sex.
I always kind of wonder. Did you gave up on the straight edge shit? Like you maybe partake in a little booze or whatever.
My girlfriend who became my wife, and I was like, I can't.
Yeah, right.
I proved my point.
Okay, and so that's kind of my question is like, I often think that people are either trying to prove a point to themselves, or it's like a control freak kind of thing. Like maybe you're scared of being out of control.
Totally. I think there is an element of that. That's not all it is, because a lot of my friends still are very much dedicated to straight edge, and I think it's a very positive movement. For me, I think it was a lot about self-discipline, and I felt like if I can discipline myself to refrain from eating animal byproducts or refrain from drinking caffeine, you know, like any of this stuff, then like I'm more powerful and more stronger and I have discipline.
Totally.
Which, it's true. Like I never cave into peer pressure to this day. Like, I'm just, you can't move me. If I don't want to do something, I'm just a rock. I don't care.
Yeah.
I never cared what, I still don't care what anyone thinks, if it's popular or not. If it's like, everyone's going here, man, or like, everyone's doing this, why aren't you wearing your shoes? Like, why aren't you wearing these shoes?
Right.
Like, why do you still do your hair like that?
Right.
You know, like, I just don't care. I just kind of do my thing. A lot of that came from being straight edge. Because straight edge, you deal so much with ridicule and people saying you're not popular and girls kind of dissing you, being like, oh, yeah, you're not cool.
Yeah.
That you kind of get over that and go like, yeah, that's totally fine and I'm happier for it.
Yeah.
And so when you grow up with that type of philosophy, for the rest of your life, it's a great foundation to just never cave into peer pressure, do what the popular kids are doing.
Tight. Yeah. I also kind of always wonder about straight edge kids. If like, I saw alcoholism run in my family kind of. And so I, as an adult, as a kid, I was off the deep end. But as an adult, I've kind of like tried to stay away from booze more only because I recognize those tendencies in myself. Like,
yeah,
I don't think I've ever fully been an alcoholic, but I feel like I got them tendencies.
Oh, for sure.
Where I don't know how to stop.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that about yourself ever, having seen your dad or you know?
Yeah. I definitely teeter on that point all the time where I'm like, yeah, maybe I can stop, chill now, but I can, you know,
Totally.
I think I know how to stop. Thankfully, I've never had any hardcore substance abuse issues, in my life. But emotional issues and psychological issues, yeah.
Totally.
I've had my share.
Totally. So when you move to LA and you have your manager, you're going on auditions, who are you writing for the side money? Oh, I guess maybe that was before the time of like just content creation.
Oh, sorry. Yeah,
you said you started writing.
Magazines.
Oh, okay,
magazines.
From magazines.
Yeah, so that was the age of magazines. And, you know, I when I was in college, I used to work at Transworld.
Oh,
we started a magazine called, it was Warp. That's where I started interning when I was in college. And then by the time I graduated college, we had turned it into Stance magazine.
Okay.
Stance was an early progenitor towards what Complex became, is street culture. That's where I found out about streetwear.
Whoa.
I used to have to call Supreme in like 1999, you know, call A Bathing Ape and ask for product for the magazine. And this was just very too early. The magazine didn't last for more than 5 years because it was just beyond, you know, like now it would make a lot of sense. But this was, again, like 2000.
Yeah.
No one understood what was going on. I wrote for Giant Robot magazine.
Did you feel when you were at Stance, did you have that sense of like, oh, we're really early adopters on this? And have you always been kind of an early adopter?
I've always been an early adopter, which is why I loved Stance so much, but I've always been an early adopter. I mean, again, like I'm always doing the opposite of where people are at, right?
Yeah.
And when you live like that, you're kind of, most of the time, more often than not, you kind of hit the next big thing.
Right.
Just because culture moves in this pendulum, right? So when everyone's over here, you're here. And then when it moves back, you're like, hey, I was already here. And then you jump ship again, you go to the other side.
Yeah.
And it's just like, it's a tortured existence where you're never popular. You're never making the money where you should be. You're always too far ahead of the game.
Right.
You know?
Well, it's funny because in the clothing industry or the streetwear industry, it must be like, oh, you guys are just seeing my ideas that I had 2.5 years ago come out now, and I'm already fucking sick of them. Wait till you see the next shit.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Right?
Exactly. In apparel, that's always what it is. We've found ways around that to where we have lines that kind of come out immediately now. We have a segment called RFN, which is like, I think of it now, and it just comes out now.
Yeah.
But that was painful to run an operation like that for years, where it's like, everything I'm being inspired by now, no one sees it for a year and a half or 2 years. And by then, some other companies have already done it, or like, you know, people who are just faster to market.
Right.
And like, that's so hard to watch.
Yeah. So after Stance goes under, did you stay there until they went
under? So my boss there was an early mentor of mine, whether or not he chose to be my mentor. He's a guy named Kevin Imamura.
Okay.
And Kevin, when I first started working there, he was editor-in-chief, and he had one day he came to work and he was wearing some Nike Dunks.
Okay. Oh,
So he was wearing Nike Dunks and had a little alphanumeric symbol on the side. Alphanumeric was Alyosha Workamora's brand, but it was an early skate brand that kind of ventured into streetwear.
Yeah.
And it was very like Japan inspired, kind of what LRG was competing against at the time.
Totally.
And they did a collaboration with Nike Dunks, which was revolutionary at that point because Nike and skateboarding culture were opposite ends of life. Like when we were growing up, skateboarding, it was so anti-corporate, like no Mountain Dew sponsors, no X Games, no Nike.
There was a long time where yeah, if you were like an alt kid, you were fucking completely anti-Nike.
You were so anti-Nike.
We all jumped over to Adidas tracksuits just because, like, fuck Nike. Adidas is tight.
Nike. Nike, the child labor was like child a big labor. Issue.
That's what it was.
And just being the man.
Yeah, totally. You know,
which was awesome about the 90s because kids really meant it when they were anti-corporate, anti-advertising. That's where the Shepherd Fairies of the world came from.
I still get a little weird when I buy Nike shoes, and I love Nike. Totally. I mean, Nike shoes are fucking great. You can't really fight that off.
Yeah.
But there's still a weird part of me left over from high school.
The only
like,
way I justify it is the only Nikes that I really buy are Jordans.
Yeah.
And Jordan brand, I'm like, oh, it's a little different than Nike swoosh.
Right.
But I wear Converse. Converse is Nike now.
Oh, yeah, that's
so,
right.
So, like, it's, you know, I can't really escape Nike. No one really can escape Nike.
Right.
But, yeah, so,
okay, so, the
so he's wearing alphanumeric dunks. And I'm like, yo, what are you doing? You're wearing Nike. He's like, yo, Nike's cool.
Right.
And I was like, why is Nike cool? Because at the end of the 90s, Japan was really capitalizing on this sneaker reselling market. And so they had held on to all these vintage Nike Dunks, Air Force Ones, and Jordans from the 80s and just stockpiled them.
Uh-huh.
And then as soon as all those kids who couldn't afford them in the 80s grew up and had the money to spend,
that's what they want.
They started flipping them for $300, $400.
Right.
And it created this huge revival for the Nike Dunk. And these guys at Alphanumeric knew it.
Mm-hmm.
Kevin at Stance Magazine knew it. And so a few people that were on the edge of culture that were watching Japan for what was next in street fashion and skate fashion were like, yo, it's moving towards Nike. And it's, you would see photos of Eric Koston being a Nike collector or Scott Johnston being a Nike collector.
Right.
And that blew my head off because I was like, yo, like, these guys are into Nike, but they're skateboarders. Like, this doesn't make any sense, but it's kind of cool because they're collecting these Nike shoes, and they're so colorful, and I wanted them, too, when I was a kid. And, like, maybe now's my chance to get those, like, you know, maple brown dunks or those, like, Jordans, whatnot. And so he was the one who put me onto that, and then he introduced me to what Supreme was. He introduced me to what a Bathing Ape was. And there came a moment where he was, like, one day, hey, you know what? I'm leaving the magazine. I'm like, yo, where are you going? He's like, I'm moving up to Portland. I'm working for Nike to run the Nike skateboarding division. He, another friend of mine named Robbie Jeffers, who was at Stussy.
Who Robbie Jeffers is.
Robbie,
I mean, I don't know him, but I know who he is. Yeah.
Sure. So there was like a lot of these guys that were big in the skate scene at the time that were getting plucked by Nike to start what Nike SB became.
Yeah.
And I don't remember why I was telling you that
story. Who knows?
Story,
it's all interesting though. So you're at Stance. And so then when he moves.
So that's why when he's like, I'm leaving.
That was your mentor.
I'm leaving too.
And so did you just dip to LA at that point?
I dipped to LA pretty much at that point.
Yeah.
And I worked at it for a year freelancing.
Yeah.
I'm a terrible freelancer. I just couldn't like get myself up in the morning. It's hard.
What kind of shit were you writing about?
I would write about anything. A lot of music reviews.
Yeah.
Magazines paid very well back then.
Right.
So especially through Transworld, I was getting $1 a word.
Oh, wow.
Mm-hmm. So $1 a word when you're 19, I was paying my rent by doing a few music reviews.
Yeah.
And then just like having cake to play with. So I would
I can't even imagine getting $500 for writing 500 words.
Can you imagine?
It would take
me like
that's
2 minutes.
That's a half an hour of work.
You know,
yeah,
it was just
nothing.
like this is how I feel about this album. I don't care. And then all the free music that we used to get doing music reviews, right? Like every Tuesday, you would just get cases from the record companies, literal like cases on your doorstep of CDs, and you just go through them. It was the best game ever. There was like 5 CDs that you actually wanted.
Right.
You listen to them. The rest of them, you take them down to the music trader.
To Amoeba, buys great.
Amoeba, 99 cent record store, listening store, whatever.
Right.
You'd sell those. I'd get another few $100.
Wow, you had the hustle.
It just was like the sweetest hustle. And then 9/11 happened.
And that market just fucking...
And everything just plummeted because the publishing industry, for the most part, most of the magazines I wrote for were in New York.
Yeah.
And all the magazines went pretty much to where it is today, but they went super skinny. And they were like, look, there's no work. There's no work. There's an advertising.
The creative industry was the first to die after 9/11.
First.
You know, it's funny. My first day of photo school, of like art school, was Tuesday, September 11th. That was my first day of class. And I remember... just all the teachers going like, wow, you guys are fucked. Like the industry is going to die. Like that's what's going
to
happen.
Wow, they already had the foresight
to just
know
knew. Like, well, I feel like within the first 2 months, they all knew like the work, photo work was going to die for a while, you know?
And no one wanted to support that stuff.
Right. Yeah. It's like, well, anytime there's any kind of economic decrease, I feel like, the creative industries are the first ones to feel it because advertising dollars gets cut.
Advertising, you know? Exactly.
And So I can always tell when they're like when photo business is slow, I can tell like, oh, we're gonna there's like rough financial times coming because companies are cutting advertising.
Yeah.
Anyhow, okay. So 9/11 happens.
9/11 happens. There's no work for me.
Yeah.
My girlfriend, who eventually became my wife, she was living in Japan at the time.
No shit.
And I was like, you know what? I cannot find work here. Like, there was months where I couldn't find work. And I was like, I'm moving to Japan. So I moved to Japan, and I started writing for magazines out there. And then that's when I really got to learn about Japanese streetwear, was doing all that research.
How would you write out there?
There were English-speaking magazines.
Okay.
For English.
For expats.
For expats that live there. So one of the magazines I wrote for, I wrote a cover story for Japan Zine. And it was about the history of Japanese hip-hop culture.
Yeah.
Which was, like, super thorough. And it was, like, you know, like I worked on that thing for like 3 months and I got paid like $2,000, but it was like what I needed to just survive. But that's where I really discovered what Japanese streetwear was about, because I was covering like King Ghidra, like all these early Japanese rap artists.
Yeah.
And then they were tied to Nigo and what Nigo his DJ work. And then it just, I was like, wait, what is this thing, a bathing ape, really? And then I started shopping at the stores, and that was like 2001. So that's when I came back and I was just like, yo, streetwear's sick.
And
that's when I moved back. But I was like, you know what? I need to get a real job. So my idea was, if I can land a stable career doing something in the day, at night I'll do my creative stuff. Like, that's just always the dream, right?
Yeah.
Like, oh, a stable career, I can have like a normal life, and instead of this freelance life that was like so up in the air every day,
right?
And at night I can like paint, because I was like a real paint. I was like trying to be an artist at the time. I was like, I want to be a painter. So I set up my kitchen in my studio apartment off of National Boulevard, and it was like all my canvases.
Hey, I live off National. Shout out.
Do you?
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Culver City.
Yeah. Yeah. I lived right next to the 10 freeway. So like my apartment would rattle.
I mean, I know exactly where you're at. Yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
So that's where I started off. And, I was like, well, if I can do my art and have a career, what would be a good career? Everyone's like, you should be a lawyer, 'cause you like to argue a lot and you write.
Yeah.
So I was like, okay, fine. So totally blindly walked into law school. Obviously, my parents...
Wait, what? You came back from Japan and go to law school?
Yeah, I went to law school.
Wow.
My parents were happy because they're like, oh, you're going to be a lawyer.
Right. Every immigrant wants their kid to be a doctor or a lawyer.
But I was like, no, I'm not going to be that kind of lawyer. I'm going in for human rights and public interest work.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I'm here for activism because I was an activist. So. Right. It's like, I'm here for like the politics stuff.
So you were fighting the good fight.
I was trying to fight the good fight.
Yeah.
And halfway through my first year, I was like, this is awful. This is the worst thing a creative person can do.
It's just all reading and memorizing,
or what? It's all, which I don't mind the reading, memorizing. Yeah. It was all about stripping down how you write. So legal writing is a course you're required to take in your first year. And the first lesson they teach you is write like you're speaking to a 3-year-old.
Right.
So all the adjectives disappear. So if you're saying the apple is red, you say the apple is red. And in the next sentence, when you're referring to apple, you say the apple is red, the red apple. And you just say the same things over and over. And I was like, no, I use apple already in this sentence.
Right.
So I'm going to use like a burgundy or like
totally
a blood-hued, fruit. And they're like, no. Use the same word over and over again. And I was like, whoa. So I did very well in law school, but that was I almost failed that class. And the teacher was like, the professor was like, look, you are going to fail this class if you're too good of a writer for this class.
Yeah.
You need to learn how to write. Like, you're talking to a 3-year-old.
You gotta turn it off.
Turn it off. And over the course of a year, I learned how to turn it off, and it killed me.
Really?
It killed my spirit. I was so depressed. And I was like, I cannot do this. And in the course of that year, I met Ben, who's my partner now.
Yeah.
And that summer, we started the project.
Did you guys click instantly?
We clicked instantly because it was over sneakers.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it's such a streetwear story. But I was wearing these Louis Vuitton Air Force Ones, and he was wearing Jordan 4s.
Yeah.
And I was like, and again.
Was that a party or where was it?
This was at school because he was
school.
In my class.
Oh.
So this is like 2002.
Yeah.
Very early in the sneaker culture.
Yeah.
Like Nike Talk was like 99. I had been on Nike Talk since like 2000.
Yeah.
So this is like only 2 years in, 2002.
You know what makes me so sad about that era is like, I saw as a cool early adopter kid, I was like, oh, the sneaker shit is going to be huge, But at the same time, I was like, I didn't have the heart in it to get obsessed over it. Like, I didn't have the money to get obsessed over it.
Sure, yeah, of course.
And I would see the dunks that were coming out that now are like, $1,500, $2,000, $5,000 sneakers. And I would just see them at the skates. Like, they were just there. Yeah. You could just get them at the time for like $90.
Yeah.
And I'm like, fuck, I wish I would have just bought a pair of those. Yeah. Like, what was I thinking?
You could have flipped them.
You know what
totally.
I mean?
Totally.
Yeah. So, anyhow.
So that was our mutual, because no one was really into sneakers. But yeah. I mean, I think like he was wearing a Supreme shirt and I was probably wearing like a Sir shirt or something, like some early streetwear thing. And I was like, yo, like, what's your deal? Like, you know, he's like, oh, I bought this at Supreme. And, you know, we had a flight in New York at the time to get Supreme. Right.
Right.
And then I was like, you into shoes? And then we just started talking. And then I was just like, I'm into this stuff. You're into this stuff. Like, let's do something this summer.
And so
that's when we started the brand.
Was the angle kind of, and this is just me looking from the outside looking in, I always have figured that he's kind of the business end and you're the creative end.
He is.
Was that dynamic kind of instant? Did he have family in the clothing industry?
He did not have family in the clothing industry, but how he looked at it was, I was an artist.
Yeah.
Really, and initially the umbrella concept was something that I was planning on doing anyways.
Right.
Because I was having such a hard time that first year of school in terms of creatively. I was like, okay, when it turns summer, I'm going to start a project where I can put my art onto t-shirts, like streetwear, get my art out there, and then I'll write about it on a blog, because I was also a blogger at the time. Like, I was just really early in the blog thing.
Yeah, that was way early.
So I was just like, I'll marry the two. They're my two favorite things. I'll just marry the two. We'll sell this clothing through this website or sell it to shops, and I'll blog about it every day. Like, that kind of makes sense, right? But no one was thinking to do anything like that. He found out what I was just like, he's like, what are you doing this summer? Let's make some money. I was like, I'm thinking of doing this thing. He's like, do you know how to make any money doing it? And I honestly, I was like, I have no plans on making money with this thing.
Is he a Persian dude?
He's a Persian Jew.
Okay.
And that's what he said. He's like, listen, I'm a Persian Jew. I'll figure out how to make
money. Where
is
he from? Like Beverly Hills?
He's from the Valley. He's not one of those Persian Jews.
Okay. I was just curious because
I'm from Encino.
You know, that's like a definite subculture of LA is like Persian Jews.
Yeah,
like, yeah.
That's an LA thing.
Business sharks, man, for sure.
Yeah, like, that's the first thing he said.
Yeah.
He's like, I'm a Persian Jew. I know how to make money. We're going to make money doing this thing. And I was like, great.
Yeah.
I wasn't planning on making any money.
Yeah.
I just wanted to do it, which is still to this day pretty much how things fall.
Right.
You know, it's like him trying to figure out how to make money. And I'm like, I don't care if it makes money. He's like, no, you need to care.
So that was what, like 02, 03?
That was 2002.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then we started the brand in 2003.
And by the time it was like by 06, it was like a thing. Like by 06, it was all over.
Which is such a short amount of time.
Yeah,
in retrospect, it sounds kind of crazy, but it seemed like it took us forever to get to that point. But we just worked for years on that thing, not knowing who was. Look, no social media, right? So you don't know how many followers we have.
Right.
You don't have any engagement. You get an email every now and then, but you don't check your web analytics. You don't know who's reading your blog.
Yeah.
By the time we figured out, like, maybe we should check our stats, it's because I said something about Pharrell that was not very nice, and Pharrell was just, like, pissed off about it. And that's when I was like, oh my God, maybe we should check the stats on this thing because people are reading. But for years, I blogged as if I was talking to myself.
And the interesting thing is at the time that it's not a revolutionary idea to start a t-shirt company.
No.
But it's a fucking revolutionary idea to create a cast of characters around a blog that makes it seem as though it's a movement.
Totally.
And that's the thing that really changed the game.
That's totally what it was. And it was just, none of that was thought out or planned.
Right.
It just
happens accidentally.
Let me document my life, which I had always been doing, right? When I was in high school, I was documenting my friend's skateboarding.
Yeah.
And we'd go to the show and I'm like, this is, and then I would not have anywhere to write it. So when Blogger popped off in 1999, 2000, then I started blogging my life. I was like, this is my friend. This is a show I want to. Here's the shoes I bought today. And that was just like when I started to attach it to a product like commerce.
Yeah.
Then it took off because now there was a way to buy into the lifestyle instead of just being a participant.
Exactly. You're selling this lifestyle and people become emotionally attached to what you're doing.
Yeah.
I always just say like, I would say, oh man, Bobby Hundreds, that guy is the king of turning anything into content. Because you could take a fucking boring ass meeting, take some wide angle pictures of it, write a summary of it, and all of a sudden it's like this cool blog post.
Yeah.
And I'm like, this guy, he's
that
like,
was
turn anything into
that
a,
was getting creative out of getting resourceful out of meager resources. I mean, most of my life is very, very starkly boring,
yeah.
99% of it. And especially when you're running a business, a lot of time is spent in meetings.
Yeah.
So you have to learn how to spin it.
Right.
It's really, if you looked at those blogs and during those years, like within a year, there was maybe like three or four, like actually really momentous occasions. You know, like Jay-Z's wearing our sweatshirt, like cool, like, or someone stopped by to visit, or we got into some crazy store, like big news, you
yeah.
know, we traveled somewhere, like traveled, great content.
Right.
Most of the time it was just us dicking around,
right.
you know, like here's a taco we ate. Let me tell you about the guy who made the taco. Let me tell you the history of this place and how it relates to LA. And I'll tell you a little bit of LA culture. And like, me just making, you know, squeezing water out of a rock, you know,
totally.
It's like anything I could find.
Well, and that makes so much sense too, as like being an introverted extrovert, you know what I mean? Of like, real creativity is turning a boring ass life into something exciting. You know what I'm
yeah.
saying? Like, if you can take something that seems mundane and make it seem like a lifestyle,
yeah.
you know what I mean? I always say one of my best Facebook posts I ever had was like, I was ordering a pizza and it said special instructions. And I said, please tell the driver to give me a high five when he gets to the door. And the guy came up and gave me a high five, and I took a picture of it. And I was like, I posted my little screenshot of that. And then people started reacting to it. They're like, update us with a picture if he does it. And so I just took a picture of it, and it like went crazy. But I was like, this is me sitting at home alone on a fucking Thursday
yeah.
night eating a pizza, and yet and still somehow you've turned into content. You
yeah.
know what I mean? And that's really the trick to content.
Yeah, I mean, being a content creator, you're really what a journalist is, right? So I was always looking for – I learned to train myself to look for the story.
Right.
So especially during those years when I would blog every single day from morning till night, I was searching for a story and I was looking for patterns. And there's always a pattern. The address of your building is 3306. The address of the building of my friend Sophia's house that I was at before is 3306.
Right.
And so, like, that's a pattern. And if I were to write a blog for today, I would probably start talking about numbers.
Right.
And
the little thymology that you see throughout
yeah.
life.
And then I would just make it A to Z and make a little intro, a little arc in the story, and then a little thing at the end. And that's
right.
how I would make every blog, whether or not I did anything of importance that day.
Right. Totally.
Yeah.
Yeah, man. It's, I don't know. It's cool to watch. It's interesting. I mean,
thanks.
It's very inspiring. Yeah,
thanks.
For certain. So how did it start feeling I remember when I used to, when the hundreds like started to come on my radar, I was just seeing kids everywhere rocking like kind of cholo inspired old English shirts. I feel
yeah.
like or that if I remember correctly, that just said like the hundreds is huge.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going like, what the fuck is the hundreds? And why are all these kids wearing these shirts that look like they're just like iron on tees or something?
Yeah.
Like, what is this? When was it that you start seeing kids rocking your shirts that you didn't know?
Oh, man. God, years and years. I actually lead a very boring lifestyle. So outside of my work and my immediate community, I go home and I don't really go out.
Yeah.
So I would hear it from other people. You know, my wife was the one who was always telling me at first, like, oh, I was at, you know, Nordstrom today and I saw a kid shopping there with his mom and he had like a one of the sweatshirts on, and I'm like, well, what did he look like? Just so I knew, like, I didn't know the kid, you know, I was just making sure, like, did
yeah.
he look like this? And
right.
I was like, oh my God, I don't think I know that guy, you know? So it was
Dude,
a lot
yeah.
of those kinds
yeah,
of
yeah.
stories very early on. And I don't remember exact point when, but it was years before
yeah.
I saw it. And does it trip me out? It still trips me out.
That's dope, man.
You know, like, I don't make a big deal about it, but when I see it, I'm like, man, that's crazy. Because, and I don't look at it like, that's crazy, I made that. I always look at that as, that's the hundreds. You're a fan of the hundreds. I'm a fan of the hundreds too. I always look at it as an objective party.
Yeah.
I think Ben and I still do, as emotionally involved as we are with what the hundreds is. We still look at it like, man, this is something we created and it's its own thing. It's like a child.
Yeah.
And so it's like seeing your child just out there and being like, man, that guy's rad. You know, I'm a
right.
fan of that guy too. Like, I'm a fan of the hundreds. They do some cool stuff.
Well,
you know?
So at this point in you guys' career, you know, do you feel like, is it something where you guys are looking for talent to bring in to help move the brand along? Or do you still feel like an ownership over it?
Oh, we
know?
Definitely still feel an ownership.
Yeah.
And we're still telling stories of our lives.
And when I say
and our
ownership, I almost mean like a fear to give up any kind of control, a fear of giving up the
We've
reins.
We've given up a lot of creative control within our team that we trust.
Yeah.
Not giving it up reluctantly, but giving it up in terms of like, now it's your turn to put your spin on it.
Right.
It started off with really just Ben and I with some t-shirts and some blogs. But now when you look at it, I mean, the jeans I'm wearing now, they were worked on by three different people with a lot of deliberation and forethought that went into these denim, like wash and story behind them. You know, like this shirt, I'm wearing a blank white shirt, but like, you know, everything, I have a great team that I trust. Yeah. They're like my family. They're extensions of myself, but they don't just, they're not just tools, like just they don't just do what we order them to do. We ask that they infuse a little bit of their story in their product as well. So it looks different, you know? Right. It looks different over time, and seasons look different from each other. And depending on who comes in to help us out, it's their interpretation as well. Ben and I are still in control. We're driving the boat, you know, but we have different people rowing in.
Yeah.
Sometimes we move a little faster. We move in this direction. And I just love it. It's like the story's constantly evolving, you know?
Right.
Like these people are a part of our experience and story too, you know, so they're as much a reflection of who we are today as what we were trying to do with the brand 10 years ago.
Right. And I'm sure a lot of people still listening at this point are just huge fans of yours, and a lot of kids, you probably have so many kids that hit you up all the time on some like, how could I work for you?
Sure. Yeah.
What kind of traits as a young boss like you are, do you look for in a young worker? Like what are the traits that show
I interned for years at Transworld before I got paid. I never cared about getting paid. I just figured out a different way to get paid. But where I was working, I just wanted to work because I wanted to learn and I wanted to contribute.
It's that passion for learning.
It's just a passion for learning and a passion to contribute to the cause. Like,
yeah.
I was a fan of Transworld, but I really wanted, because I believed in Transworld, I wanted to see the culture create and continue.
Right.
And, you know, we get a lot of interns that come in or people looking for a job, and they're just fans.
Right.
And they're fans more or less of what they've seen on the internet. So it looks like all fun and games. It's the Gucci main party. It's, you know, me shooting a naked Carucci on my DeLorean. It's like, you know, eating good food all the time. No, again, like 99% of my life is actually very mundane. It's all business. Like work is work at the end
emails,
of the day.
Yeah.
And a lot of people, a lot of younger people, they don't last very long because they're like, man, this sucks. Like, this is not what I expected.
Right.
So people need to kind of come in willing to work, you know, down for the cause. And, you know, like, I don't know. I just look for, we always tell anyone who gets hired right away, I'm going to drop you off in the deep end. And you are going to teach yourself how to swim. I'm not teaching you how to swim here.
Totally.
I just don't have the time or the patience. I'm not a good teacher. I'm really not the best boss. But what I will do is if you've taught yourself how to swim after a year or two, I'll come over to your side of the pool and I'll be like, all right, now follow me.
Totally.
But like, that's the only way to do it. A lot of people come in, they're like, hey man, like you didn't teach me how to do this, or, you know, you were never there to direct me and I thought you were the director here. And I'm like, mm-mm, nope.
I'm
here to learn from you.
You know what that sounds like?
Hmm.
Your dad.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely.
Right?
It's absolutely.
Oh, man. Yeah. How's your relationship with your son?
Oh, I have two boys. And they're my best friends,
Do you find yourself like almost wanting to be the antithesis of what that was? Like, do you
I try to be, but so much. There are some days where I come everything short of hitting them.
You know,
I'm like as much my dad as I try not to be. Like that's in my blood.
Yeah,
I'm a Korean man.
Right,
you know, I'm strict, really stern with them. I value hard work, and being humble and being respectful. Like I try to ingrain that in my children.
But at the same time, I bet that you hug them and tell them you love them.
Oh my God. I hug them way too much. I'm like doing the opposite where I hug them too much to where like they don't want any, they're like, that's enough. You know, like I smother them. I smother them in public. I'm the worst.
Yeah.
I'm like still like mouth kissing them. And like my older one's like 6 years old and he's just like, stop, this is gross. And I'm just like, but you're like, I'm such a fan of my children.
So
like,
you were a pretty young dad then. You had kids pretty young.
I had, well, for LA, it's probably
for
pretty
LA
young
standards.
But I had my first kid when I was 29, 30.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Are they like, I mean, dude, they have like a cool dad. Do they recognize that? Are they into the shit you're into? Or do they be like, dad, you're so dumb, dad. No, dude.
They're starting to get like that now, but they still think it's pretty cool. Like when they see Adam Bomb around,
yeah,
you know, like they're like, there's dad's boss.
Right. Totally.
The guy he works for.
Yeah. Are they getting into skating?
No. Well, they kind of, I have this weird thing with skateboarding where I still look at it as a counterculture and as a rebellious sport.
Yeah.
I don't think a dad should teach his son how to skate. That's my thing.
That's funny. My best friend's a skate dad and I always clown on him. He's like a total skate dad.
I want my kids to discover it and be like, yeah, this is a bad thing.
Yeah.
And I do it because it's not what my dad does.
Right.
You know, and
that's interesting.
I don't want to spoil it for him. Like, I'm a dad. I'm uncool.
Yeah.
I'm going to spoil it for them.
Well, I mean, like, so my best friend lives down in San Diego and it's like, dude, down there, skating is like little league now.
Yeah, it's little. And that's what I don't want.
Yeah. But I mean, at the same time, his kids fucking rip because of it.
Yeah, sure.
It's crazy.
But like, I think eventually if they want to do it, they'll find it and love it. And they'll do it because they want to do it, not because I pushed them into doing it.
Yeah, totally.
And like, I push them into playing basketball, soccer, all the other sports, because that's just what, you know, American culture, that's what you do.
Right.
But with skateboarding, I want them to discover it like a paintbrush almost. Like, I just kind of want them to make their own art.
Where are you with social media right now? I know sometimes you're like super tweet. It used to be
last year.
Used to be battled with Twitter, and now it's like kind of sparse.
Yeah. I mean, look, social media, so much of everything is a game for me, or it's a challenge, right? And I feel like I mastered what I wanted to get out of a lot of social media, you know, like with Twitter, I ran it for as long as I could. I use it to tell jokes because I hate talking about myself and I don't like to sell.
Yeah.
And that's what a lot of early Twitter was like people just mindless babble and talking too much about themselves
totally.
And selling something. And I was like, well, maybe if I tell jokes, it's my way of having a presence here and not and getting away,
right.
getting around all that stuff. So I did that for as long as I could. And that early Twitter humor kind of has gotten old. A lot of those early Twitter comedians, like it's so dated now, the format.
Right.
And just over the past half year, I've gotten really back into Twitter again. I think they've figured out some great algorithms and the way that they structure the content now. It's like, I love Twitter again.
Yeah.
Instagram, I just have like an ambivalent relationship about.
Yo,
you know,
I think
like,
Instagram's dying. I've been saying that. I think it's dying the slow death right now. Right?
It's totally done.
People look at me so crazy. Like my.
What are you talking about?
Like my normcore friends look at me like, what are you talking about? Instagram's cool.
People discovered it 2 years ago.
Yeah,
no, cool.
And I'm like, nah, dude, Instagram's dying. Like,
You know what it is? It's not dying, and I don't think it'll ever die. But what it was dying,
yeah, right.
You know? And so now what it is, it's the internet. It's just websites.
Everyone finds that hustle, whether it's MySpace or Facebook or whatever. And so Instagram became a place where gals can sell tea or, you know what I mean? Or
it's
you
just
can
a hustle.
Sell
it's
your
people,
workout
marketing,
products. Yeah, totally.
Marketing
it's marketing.
And sales. And yeah. If you have a company or brand, you use
totally.
Instagram.
Yeah, man. That's one thing that I've always kind of loved about what you do is like, you're not one to flex. You know what I mean? And when you talk about, I don't go on Twitter and talk about myself, like that's true. Like I think that you're smart and humble enough to just kind of let the work speak for itself. And I always respect when somebody does that. So that being said, I appreciate you coming in, taking your time out of your busy schedule to come do this.
Thank
this
you.
Is great. And I think a lot of kids will be very happy and inspired by it. And the reason I brought up Twitter is because I say, shout out your Twitter, tell the people where to find
everything
you online.
Bobby Hundreds.
At Bobby
Snapchat.
Hundreds.
Snapchat is my main.
Oh,
go-to.
Yeah. I heard like you, I haven't followed your Snapchat. I'm not really, really out here on Snapchat like that, but I keep seeing the tweets about your Snapchat being funny.
You know, I do it every now and then, but I love my Snapchat and I love how Snapchat works and engages.
Yeah.
And I think it's the best platform.
That's
right
the
now.
Next one. Yeah, that's the big one. All right. Cool, man. Well, shit. Thank you for doing this. It was really dope.
This was great.
Yeah. Thank you, man. My name is Lee. Some of you guys might know me as Intuition, and this was kind of neat. You guys can follow us at It's Intuition. You can follow us at Kind of Neat. You can follow my man Ben Shin behind the boards making the shit sound buttery at I Am Database, based with two S's, and youtube.com/kindofneat where you can see all the artists we've had on performing. Don't forget about that patreon.com/kindofneat where if you are a regular user, please go donate a dollar or two per episode. It would be very helpful and we appreciate it. That being said, that was Bobby. I'm Lee, and this was Kind of Neat.
Sweet.